Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 4:59 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is October 7th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And it was a big day on the downside. So the Nasdaq was down 400 points, back testing the 11,000 level, which was the low from the end of September and back in June. So this is an important level where if support is going to come back in, it would really be opportune for it to appear on Monday. Now, when we zoom out and look at this over a 10-year time scale, we can clearly see that the NASDAQ 100 is below the 1,000-day moving average. This is only the second time in more than a decade that it has done that. We have two lower rally highs. We have ranges, one below the last. And obviously, this is not bullish activity. Let's just think, I guess, about what works in a bull market. How do we characterize bull markets? So, bull markets can be characterized first by rising prices, by the expectation they will continue to rise, then by investor activity around those two beliefs, and then a realization of what the most productive strategy is in a bull market. So, after a bear market, it takes time to convince people a new bull market has begun. So, that's the disbelief stage. Then you get the acceptance stage because people have started to make money. The people that saw the potential in the early stage of the bull market are making money, and they tend to proselytize. Then, as you make more money, as the trend it starts to attract more adherence, it becomes more consistent. So then you get the acceptance stage. Now that can take quite a long time. Because there will be occasions when the resolve of the bull is tested. And we've seen plenty of occasions like that, particularly in the period in 2010, 11, 12, and in 15, 16. Particularly back in 2010, 11, and 12, there was still a lot of fear around that the second shoe was going to fall. That the financial crisis had not yet been banished, and that we were going to see prices revisit the lows put in late 2008. But that never happened. And the index continued to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And then we got a series of events unfolding so that there were clear monetary policy supports for the market. Every time it came back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average, the Federal Reserve stepped up and made abundant liquidity available. That worked in 2010, 11, 12. Worked in 2015 and 16 because the ECB stepped in with a significant stimulus. It worked in 2018 and 19. Right at the end of the year, the stock market was down over 20%, and Steve Mnuchin convened the plunge protection team on Boxing Day, and got all of the CEOs of the major banks in a room and said, "Let's support this market," and they did. They went in and they bought. The market went straight up in early 2019. The Federal Reserve stopped raising rates. They started cutting rates in late 2019. The market was breaking out in 2020. Then we had the pandemic, pulled back to the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and then bounced with monetary accommodation on a scale that had never before been seen. And we got a beautiful acceleration. So then we get the mania phase. So we went from disbelief in 2009, 10, 11, and 12 to acceptance between 2013 and 2020, when people were just willing to accept that the technology bull market was unfolding, that these huge companies were going to continue to expand and take market share, and that it was a matter of course that whenever there was a sign of trouble, that the Federal Reserve would step in because inflation has been banished, the great moderation has taken place, deflationary forces are evident, and every time there's trouble, the Federal Reserve would come in and start printing money. And that has been the belief system that has supported the buy the dip strategy. So at the beginning of a bull market, you get a lot of volatility, and that's the time when you can get the best value, but it's going to be so volatile that it's difficult to hold on to long positions. During the acceptance phase, when the trends become more consistent, then buy and hold works best. And the buy and hold strategy is something that withdraws supply from the market and improves the consistency of the trend. And the trading strategy that goes best with it is buying the dip. So, how do you buy the dip? Well, in a secular bull market, you buy when the market comes back to test the 1,000-day moving average. And that is generally the best time to initiate long positions. So, that's exactly what we had in June. But this is after we had the mania phase, because between March of 2020 and the end of 2021, the Nasdaq more than doubled. And that's a big move by any characterization, but particularly for a large cap index that has most of the largest companies in the world in it. So for an index of that size to double is a really significant event. People were buying hand over fist, and there was absolutely no constraint on position size. With the quantity of money that had been printed, with retail investors becoming progressively more active in the market, and with retail investors being able to do that, both because they were provided with additional cash by governments. And then we had financial innovations that allowed for greater access. So some of those include commission-free trading, which makes the process of trading a lot easier. And then, of course, you can do it on your phone. So you don't have to sit at your desk. You can trade from anywhere. And then you have ETFs, which make it much easier to just buy the market. Now we're getting single name stock ETFs, and they only exist for a single reason, to reduce the purchase price so that you can buy individual shares that are trading at hundreds or thousands of dollars in price to an acceptable level, and then to reduce the cost of the options on those shares. So these innovations contribute to leverage. They contribute, they provide retail investors with the means to increase their positions. And that all contributed to a beautiful acceleration of the trend between March of 2020 and late 2021. Then we had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And the index pulled back below the 200-day moving average. Then it encountered resistance in the region of the MA in March. Then it dropped down to test the 1,000-day moving average. And that was viewed as a reflex buying opportunity by the majority of investors. But the missing ingredient on this occasion was that central banks were not participating. So that's a clear anomaly. So, first we have the inconsistency of the acceleration. Subsequently, we have the inconsistency of the bicatalyst being absent. And now the index is back below the 1,000-day moving average. And with the strong jobs report in here today, it's increasingly likely that the Fed funds rate is going to go up by another 75 basis points in November. So then we can also think about the fact that major bull markets thrive on liquidity. You cannot have a bull market without liquidity. You need a new source of fresh cash to appear in order to drive prices higher. And then you need successive waves of new cash coming into the market. So the Nasdaq is now breaking down, and this is clearly threatening and arguably has broken the secular bull market. And we're only 39 points away from the low and the 11,000 level. If it breaks below this area, well, then it's going to rush down to 10,000, and it may not stop there. But then the question, of course, will be, is the 1,000-day moving average going to become future resistance? And will we have another step lower in what is a very consistent trend overall? And I think this is something that most investors are not prepared for. The worst case scenarios that many investors have is that we'll come back down to test the 2020 peak, which is around 10,000. Now that's a meaningful pullback. Coming from about 17,000 down to 10,000 is a significantly it's a significant move on the downside. But we're still in an environment where interest rates are rising and inflationary pressures are still not under control. And on top of that, we have oil prices. So there are two primary conditions that contribute to a recession and contribute to, perhaps more importantly, difficulties in the financial sector. The first is when money supply evaporates. And the second is a surge in oil prices. So, crude oil was not up in a dynamic manner on any particular day, but it did jump $3 today. But over the balance of the week, it's turned into a big upward dynamic. And that begins to suggest that this is a low of at least near term, but potentially medium term significance. And we can see why. OPEC came out this week and said that they're going to restrict supply by 2 million barrels. And the Biden administration has been selling oil out of the strategic reserve at a rate of 1 million barrels a day since March. And that process is due to end at the end of this month. So that then is going to restrict supply by 3 million barrels a day in total. So then the question is, are we going to see demand deteriorate by 3 million barrels a day in order to hold prices where they are right now? And the pass-through may not be quite as timely. Ultimately, during a recession, we're going to see demand for oil collapse, and there will be repercussions in the commodity markets, but perhaps not immediately. So then we see prices potentially continuing to move higher from here. ExxonMobil continues to test its all-time peaks and is now back right at the upper side of the long range that's been forming for the last 12 years. But is it going to be able to sustain a move higher from here? What I found interesting today was that natural gas prices were going the opposite direction of oil and were in mildly negative territory, but still holding the sequence or the medium-term sequence of higher reaction lows overall. and European natural gas prices were softer as well. But I think it's important to highlight that with European gas prices, a lot of the big move that we saw on the upside during the summer was about forced buying that was completely price insensitive by governments. And Germany in particular has spent a fortune at buying gas for the winter, but they're bumping up against the physical limitations that they have on storage. So that would then suggest that they will be back in the market in due course, but perhaps not quite until they've actually used some of the gas they've stored. So what we can anticipate over the winter is that gas prices will be exceptionally volatile. And when sovereigns come back into the market to buy up supply, we're going to see spiky activity. Then let's just also pay attention to the fact that carbon credit prices are still holding in a relatively tight range, particularly relative to the size of the move we've had since 2017. One of the things that's been at the back of my mind, it's not a fully formed idea, is that carbon credits are likely to be a future form of fixed income, in that you buy them and they will appreciate in line with the economy. And in the event that the economy rolls over, then governments will produce less of them, and therefore you're going to get at security in terms of downside protection with leverage on upside protection. And they are holding up reasonably well, particularly compared to stock markets. So they offer something of a security in a portfolio, but that's especially true now because bond prices have been selling off aggressively. And we have to remember that it's really not all that long ago that German bunds had negative yields, and they maintained those negative yields for years. And now the price is down from 180 to 137, and still going down. Now, I did have a question in here today from a subscriber and asking about whether the second shoe is going to fall for the pensions industry in the UK. One thing that's, I think, quite relevant is that the UK government has permissioned enough of spending by the Bank of England to exceed what's already been spent. So the market will test the lows around 5%, and what they're going to test is the Bank of England's resolve to continue to defend that level, at least on the long end of the curve. And this is de facto yield curve control, in a manner very similar to what we have in Japan, where the Bank of Japan is targeting only the 10-year, but they're not targeting any other part of the curve. And I suspect that's also what we're going to have with the UK. But the bigger point here is that this issue with UK pensions, where there were massive margin calls went out to a significant number of schemes, is really only the thin end of the wedge, because pensions have been in an exceptionally difficult position. When bond yields go down, then not only do private asset prices rise, but when you have exceptionally low yields, you've got to buy an awful lot of them in order to generate the kinds of returns that pensions need to meet their liabilities. So what they did was they looked at what's been working, and the Yale Endowment, was the fund that pioneered investing in private assets. And they outperformed everywhere else. So now every pension fund has been doing the same thing. And they're all investing in private assets. But the problem is that those private assets are not marked to market. And then we can think about utilities. So I think the more important point first is that Treasury yields this week bounced from 3.5%. This is still a consistent uptrend, and that's the most recent higher reaction low. The dollar index remains in a clear uptrend. Now, I think if we look at what has happened historically, this is a really significant breakout from a lengthy ranging phase. So the first area of realistic potential resistance is 120. A lot of people are talking about a new Plaza Accord, and the Plaza Accord was in 1985. So, we haven't had anything even remotely close to the kind of move in the dollar that we had in the early 1980s. That was on the back of inflation finally being broken, economic activity starting to return, and valuations that were rock bottom. And then the dollar surged in value. So, we're not at that position today. The first thing is that inflation has not been beaten. Valuations are still very high, and value is ethereal at present. The other point, of course, is that the German and Japanese economies were doing very well, and both the Deutschmark and the yen were artificially depressed. So the Plaza Accord was not so much about about devaluing the dollar, but finding other currencies that could appreciate against it. Now, when you look at it from that perspective, well, what currency region is going to allow its currency to appreciate in a big fashion against the dollar? It's certainly not going to be Europe, not when they are looking down the barrel, not only of a recession or an energy crisis, but probably energy problems for at least the next couple of years. Because without access to Russian supply, they're going to have difficulty refilling their storage facilities after this winter. So that's going to be a lot more LNG. So when we think about the potential for the euro to take that burden, it looks unlikely. Then let's just go to the next currency, the yen. Japan does not want a stronger currency. They don't want to abandon their yield curve control policy. They're still worried about deflation, so they're courting inflation. And they believe that this is their only chance, particularly in view of their demographics, that if they don't get inflation moving now, it might never happen. Then the next one would be the Chinese renminbi. So China's devaluing its currency, and the onshore renminbi hasn't really moved at all this week because of Golden Week. But it's right in the region of the lows from 2019 and 2020. Economic growth is deteriorating. The number of trips taken during Golden Week was down over 30% overall. And the long period of appreciation between 2005 and 2014 is over. So it's unlikely that the Chinese are going to allow the renminbi to appreciate. Even if they do then move to a floating currency, it would probably sharply depreciate before eventually steadying. So when people talk about the potential for a plaza accord, everyone is complaining about the strength of the dollar, but there's no real solution. So then it's probably a better indication of what people have done with their money. If people are whining about the strength of the dollar and the need for a clear multilateral intervention, well, it means they're still long. And there's nothing to suggest that the dollar is about to reverse course just yet. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't problems. And one thing that is particularly relevant is that the dollar has remained strong because government tax receipts have been surging. With the significant decline that we've seen in stock markets, capital gains tax receipts have surged. That's padded out the finances of both the government and the states. So they are not predicting, but it's obvious that tax receipts are going to be lower next year because you can't sell twice. So, with this capital gains bonus that's come through, that's not likely to last. But the rising trend in yields is going to become problematic. So, the best way to look at that is the total return on the 10-year yield. And it is now pulling back. And this has not been updated since October. So it was pulling back from the thousand day, excuse me, yes, the thousand day moving average back in August. Whereas now it's way down from there. So what we have here is a completing top formation. There has never been an occasion when the total return on bonds was below the 1,000-day moving average. I remember being at a double line presentation in Los Angeles about 4 years ago, and I remember talking to one of the portfolio managers, and we were talking about this index, and I remember saying to him, "Well, I think the bond market will be over when this eventually breaks down." And his response was, and I'm sure this was not the opinion of Jeff Gundlach, but what his response was is, "I don't think it can possibly pull back." So that was what we had in the bond market. We had this perception that bonds were always good value, that buying the dip in bonds always worked. And now it's not working. And we have a completing top formation in the most consistent trend in the world. So we are now looking at bear markets in both bonds and equities. Now, the bull market that we've had with the monetary accommodation of the last decade was often characterized as the everything bubble. And perhaps nothing characterizes that more than Bitcoin. So, Bitcoin prices are hovering here around 19,500. There's nothing consistent about this trend any longer. So, it is back below both the 200 and the 1,000-day moving averages. And in fact, it's distributing below the 1,000-day moving average, and it has never done that before. When we look at this on a log scale chart, then obviously the big advance was between 2010 and 2014. And now we're coming back into the region of the upper side of the underlying range, and it's never really sustained a move back into one of these lengthy ranges. So there is the real potential that it's going to break down. It would be exceptionally unlikely for Bitcoin to hold out when everything else is declining. And when it breaks down through 19,000, then it's probably going to be at 10,000 in a matter of days. And one of the big challenges with holding Bitcoin on an exchange and trying to sell is that it's not set up to cater to large numbers of sell orders. So then what happens to people is they get postponed and they don't get filled until prices are significantly below where their order was, and there's absolutely nothing they can do about it. That would suggest that if one is still holding, then there is an acute risk that Bitcoin is going to follow the Nasdaq lower. But more importantly, I've often characterized Bitcoin as a liquidity barometer. When it eventually does break lower, it's going to be a clear indication that liquidity conditions are tightening up to a really troubling level. And then we can think about the high yield bond spreads. So it pulled back yesterday and it will have bounced again in here today. But the trend is still clear and it's above 500 basis points. And it's when high yield spreads are above 500 basis points that trouble starts to evolve in the stock market. So we're at the point now where the Federal Reserve is likely to raise rates again, and they've tightened so much so quickly that it's likely that they've probably gone too far and are going to create a deflationary shock in the system. So mortgage rates are at 6.66%, up from 3% at the beginning of this year. This is the highest mortgage rate we've seen since 2001. Excuse me, 2007. So when we think about what we're looking at here, this is a phenomenally large move. It's going to kill demand in the property sector. And the only way that one could purchase today would be with abundant cash because prices haven't really started to come down yet. It's particularly relevant to look first at the house price index, and it hasn't really moved. It's down one tick. But when we look at it instead at the month over month rates, then prices are falling faster than they ever did during the global financial crisis. We went from a growth rate of 2% plus a month to negative practically instantly. And that didn't happen for a lengthy time. To go from about a growth rate of 1.6 down to where we are right now took the better part of a year. During 2005 and 6, we had it in a month in 2022. Now, we only get earnings reports every quarter, and we only get economic statistics every quarter, and they're reported a quarter in arrears. Some of the most useful aren't updated all that often. I'd love to see the Wuxia shadow rate updated, but they haven't bothered to update it since February, and that was when it was just crossing up through zero. When we think about where the epicenter of risk is, well, I think pension funds are very much at the epicenter of risk. I've been talking about pensions being exposed for years now, and I've seen just some egregiously risky behavior in private equity because I was invited to a conference It was like a fund manager's speed dating event at the Ritz in Palm Springs a few years ago. Chatting to a guy who'd just been working at PIMCO. One of the clients had recruited him to start investing in private equity. Well, the guy was an equity portfolio manager. He didn't know the first thing about private equity, but he was just handed $200 million by a client to go off and do something about it. And then I've seen where one of the family offices that I consult with, they sold one of the investments they'd made, venture investments they'd made in a company, and it was the Australian Teachers' Pension Fund bought a portion of it, and then it was another pension fund bought the rest. So pension funds have been buying into venture for at least the last decade, and some of them will be on highly appreciated assets, but because there has been such incredible competition, then what we've had instead is a feeding frenzy with these funds attempting to outbid one another. So private equity companies are also back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, the listed ones, well, they've already sold, at least they've sold themselves. And they've raised some cash. But we often hear about the significant cash sitting on the sidelines, and it's upwards of $3 trillion waiting to buy into a big decline. That alone is something that has deterred people from really taking money out of the market. It's one of the rationales for thinking that the market's going to bounce any day now because this quantity of cash is going to get deployed. But one of the primary reasons why pensions were so eager to invest in private equity and venture was because there was no alternative. But with 3-month yields at a rate that's reasonable. So the 3-month is up to 33.33%, and the 2-year yield is already up around the 4% level. Well, that's not a bad return. And if you can put your money away for 4% a year, well, it's better than losing 20% in the stock market. We had a bounce earlier in the week because it was the beginning of the quarter. But, and this has been a terrible year for many money investors. I was invited today by the National Association of Independent Money Managers to attend their conference and give a little talk. So I'll be at that. They're holding it here in Dallas in later this month. But the topic of the talk was why was or what were the signals that pointed to a top? I've been shorting the Nasdaq since March because I saw that the 200-day moving average was suddenly turning into resistance, and that was a direct analog to what we saw in 2008 when the market pulled back. We're in a situation right now where interest rates are rising and oil prices are high. So those are contributing factors to recessions and to problems in the credit markets. So that alone should be enough to suggest that prices are going to fall further from here. But I'm also very keenly aware of the fact that semiconductor prices have also been really high. Now, I wasn't able to find longer term data, but this is data from 2020 until 2021 for the price of the RTX chip from NVIDIA on eBay. So the price went from around let's call it $1,200 to $2,500 by the end of 2021. Now, we can think about the kinds of things that create new bull markets. Let's just think about the semiconductors index. So, back in 2000, we had this phenomenally large advance, and the index went from 183 to 1300. So we're talking about, it's not 10 times, but it's significant multiples. What that did was it represented a massive investment in physical infrastructure. This was the boom to build the internet. We had massive investments in producing semiconductors and memory, different kinds of chips. We put down phone lines. Everybody bought routers and created the internet. Then we had a triple waterfall crash. So we had fears about Y2K, which accelerated demand, pulled forward sales from far into the future. Then that created a rush to build manufacturing capacity to meet the accelerated demand. Then interest rates went up, the economy stalled, demand evaporated, supply came onto the market over the next couple of years, and semiconductor prices collapsed. So then, with low semiconductor prices, with a massive inventory that needed to be cleared, the kinds of businesses that began to prosper were Amazon Web Services, where they built warehouses full of servers, and they were able to buy those servers at an attractive price. They were able to create value by exploring the cloud, and that contributed to a significant boom in outsourcing of in-house computing power. But now chips are expensive. Chips are not available, and we've been through this phenomenal advance with the pandemic accelerating demand because everyone suddenly needed to work from home, could not wait for their supply. We've had successive competing rounds of companies bidding up how much they're going to spend on new manufacturing capacity. Just this week, Micron Technology said they're going to spend $100 billion on building a factory capable of employing 50,000 people in upstate New York. But that follows on from huge investments in every other major economy in the world to build their own manufacturing capacity. It stands to reason that when that capacity comes online, there is going to be a massive flood of new semiconductors, new chips, and new memory looking for a home. So we're going to see then a similar kind of build. After this bear market, there's going to be a lot of cheap chips around. So people are going to find things to do with them. So we will have the artificial intelligence networks, we'll have more supercomputers, and there will be more computing power devoted to things like material science and to the biotechnology sector. But that manufacturing capacity is not available yet. And prices now are not all that dissimilar to where they were back in September of 2000. So the bull market in the past was not as big. Now let's look at some of the, or not as lengthy, I should say. AMD has clearly broken down through the 1,000-day moving average. And Nvidia is already well below the 1,000-day moving average. So these are clearly at risk of unwinding all of their big bull markets. Then, of course, we have Tesla. So Tesla is making big promises. The first is that everyone's going to want to pay for an electric vehicle, but they keep raising the price. And in a rising interest rate environment where money supply growth is contracting and not rising, well, then how on earth are people going to afford them? That's just a simple question. But the valuation is such that selling cars is the least of their worries. What they really need to do is to figure out how does this autonomous driving work. And they say that they're 95% of the way there. But that's kind of like saying that by cycling your bicycle, you're 95% of the way to critical velocity to take off. They're just not the same thing. When we think about the question of autonomous driving, it's not that you can get a car to drive on its own along the highway, where there's very well-defined road markings. It's can you get a car to make a split-second decision about whether to hit someone or not, or to identify a person that's waving on the side of the road, or somebody that's just fallen into the road. So these are the kinds of things that a human can do without thinking, whereas it requires computing power and timing for a car to do the same thing. And this isn't just a brute force compute. This requires an acute change in how computing power is allocated. And it's, I think, probably going to be more about neural nets. The bigger point is that it's unlikely to be available in 2023, and not least because it's going to require regulations to change. So that is not in Tesla's price. It's the biggest options market in the world for any single stock. Just to put that into perspective, if we look at just option volume, just as for one stock, we have thousands of contracts on the long side and 13,000 contracts, 5,900 contracts available on the short side. Now let's look at the options for the SPY. And you have large option volume, but this is for the entire index. So when we think about Tesla, it has the significant potential to move the market. Apple might be a larger company, but it doesn't have nearly the same size of short interest. But the big challenge here for Apple is that it is a highly cyclical company. So what we're looking at here is very realistically the end of a secular bull market, that a lot of the conditions that contributed to the big move on the upside over the last 12 years are no longer present. That this is not just a medium-term correction, but that we're in a different environment. And that perhaps means we're in a more volatile environment. I suspect, at least, that the Federal Reserve is not going to be able to get control of inflation in this economic expansion. That they will have to make liquidity available, but then they're going to have to take it out a lot faster the next time. And that will contribute to a great deal of volatility and also shorter cycles. The other big point, of course, is that the yield curve spread has been negative now for months, and it's still very low. perhaps something that is nobody really tends to pay attention to is that the normal course of events is that the stock market does reasonably well during an inversion and does worst after the market or after the yield curve spread moves up through zero and trends higher. That's because it's when the Federal Reserve eventually does cut interest rates. It's because earnings are falling and the economy is in free fall. Then they overcompensate and you get a very sharp yield curve correction. At the moment, the market is pulling back more aggressively. So this is not a normal correction. And there is the potential that we're going to have shocks. You cannot have bonds and equities falling together without somebody being caught with their pants down. And we've often considered that Apple was going to have an issue after Steve Jobs died. And perhaps Amazon hasn't done quite as well since Jeff Bezos has been jumping on rockets to go have little basically join the Mile High Club in orbit. But the risk parity strategy is something that's under a great deal of stress this year. And Bridgewater is far and away the biggest, most successful of the big hedge funds. And they pioneered risk parity. And now you have Ray Dalio stepping away from the helm. So I thought that was an interesting sidebar this week when we have such volatility and the strategy that he's known for pioneering as is underperforming in a really significant fashion. So the size of the pullback now is much larger than what we had in 2020. And it's come from 26 to 17. So this is a meaningful pullback for a strategy that is heavily reliant on bonds. Now, of course, eventually bond yields will get to a point where they will become attractive. But ultimately, we're going to have to see governments curtailing spending. And that's going to be forced upon them. Governments are never going to voluntarily stop spending. So we already know that the US government have hired 80,000 new IRS employees, or it's some exceptionally large number. And they're obviously there to collect taxes. Well, it's not a problem right now because government finances are flush with cash. But it will eventually have something for them to do because 2023 is not going to have the same kind of tax returns as 2022. And property prices are starting to roll over. There's still a huge amount of demand for collectibles. But that's not going to last if asset prices are falling everywhere. I do keep an eye on Hermes. So this is the buy the dip stock because it's considered that their customers are price insensitive. And it did bounce from the region of the 1,000-day moving average in June. And it bounced back above the 200-day moving average, and now it's back in the region of the 200-day moving average. Well, I think it's reasonable to conclude that if Hermes breaks down, then we really are at the end of this big boom in collectibles, because a lot of there was, I think, an auction just 2 weeks ago where one of their bags went for a princely sum. So that probably helped to support the price. But if we're looking at asset prices declining in a significant fashion, then that is going to weigh on all stocks. Now, it doesn't mean that we're not going to have bull markets in the future. And we know where government policy is pointing. And I think that it's especially important that copper has not rebounded. It did pause, but it was down heavily in here today. And there's the potential that copper is going to break lower. If we take a 360,000 mile view and look at what's going on in terms of a strong dollar, rising interest rates, and the pressure coming to bear on private assets, and the fact that we have a war going on in Ukraine and a trade war going on with China. Well, there is the potential that the strength of the dollar and rising interest rates is not only to get in control of inflation, but it serves the dual purpose of putting extraordinary pressure on dollar borrowers internationally. And the Chinese property market and property developers were far and away the largest issuers of US dollar denominated debt. And that was one of the primary vehicles for boosting leverage for them for about 2 years. They went from zero to over 500 billion in issuance in the space of about 18 months, and then the government cut them off. I do wonder whether the USA today is attempting to do to China what it did to the USSR and strangle it economically. They announced today that more t different kinds of chips will not be exported to China. They continue to raise rates. The dollar is exceptionally strong, and property prices in China are declining. Copper prices are rolling over. So that's indicative of weakness in China. Now, obviously, we've had the Golden Week, and the market's going to open up again on Monday. But I'm not alien to the possibility, at least, that what we're seeing right now is an attempt to break China. And that's both an economic and geopolitical objective of the USA. So they may be willing to try and force a property crash in China in order to bring the country to heel. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility. And certainly the strength of the dollar is less of an issue for the USA as an energy exporter than it is for just about everywhere else. We've also seen that the petrodollar system is under significant threat. There was a Wall Street Journal article, I believe in June of this year, talking about Saudi Arabia and China negotiating about selling oil in yuan or accepting yuan for oil. And it hasn't gone anywhere just yet. But we do know that Saudi Arabia is not buying treasuries. Now, the whole petrodollar system was a massive vendor financing operation where the USA bought Saudi Arabian oil, and in return, they also provided Saudi Arabia with security guarantees. And then Saudi Arabia spent the money they received on US treasuries. So we had a vendor financing agreement. Now, Saudi Arabia is fighting a proxy war in Yemen against Iran, and they've got no assistance. And they've been bombed, and missiles have landed in Saudi Arabia on several occasions. And the dollar has been abused by a decade of quantitative easing. So They're not buying treasuries anymore, and treasury yields are rising. So anyone holding treasuries is losing money. The efforts to support the dollar and to improve the geopolitical position of the USA are all very much tied to the to defending the sovereign or the reserve currency status. So there are certainly a lot of machinations going on. And of course, now that the USA is an energy exporter, they have a vested interest in prices remaining higher for longer. And they don't particularly need prices to go back below $40. So, and what I thought was interesting is that they are discussing now amending the Sherman Act to accuse OPEC of antitrust. And that's a an incredible example of extraterritoriality that the USA has been able to implement for much of the last century. So it is a big question whether they'll be able to continue to do that and whether they'll make more friends than enemies. And of course, it's all against the background of the fact that they're not drilling, that the US could decide to increase supply, but that the companies aren't doing it. And they're not doing it because of regulation and because of costs. At the fact of the matter is that shale oil is very capital intensive, and the cost of capital is rising. And then it's also very dependent on regulatory ease, and regulations are tightening up. So, and then of course, companies and investors can't be seen to be investing in oil. And it's one of the best performing sectors this year and last year. But if we are moving into a recession, which appears likely, then we're going to see those prices starting to come back down. So we're certainly in a difficult environment. When we go through a recession, there are going to be a lot of cheap assets. Those will be the seeds for new bull markets. But we're nowhere near that yet, and we're going to have to see a clear pivot and valuations improve considerably to really drive a new bull market. So it's not the time to buy just yet. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.